How are you?
Very good, and I hope you are too.
I am, but not bad.
Yeah, it's cold here too. A little bit later in the day, I'll be vacuuming up some leaves.
I'm afraid our front yard is full of them as well. We have a
Yeah.
huge oak tree, and it's starting to deposit its leaves for us.
Well, okay. I guess our listeners aren't interested in our adventures with leaves.
Probably not. No.
I'll welcome you to the podcast, A Life in Biography. We're going to be talking about your biography of Richard Tregaskis, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
You are.
And you have a subtitle, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. But before we discuss the particulars of the book, tell us a little bit about yourself. And I'm very curious, how did you become a biographer?
Well, it was a long journey, and I can truthfully say that my path to becoming biography probably started in third grade when I was at Mary Phillips Elementary School in Mishawaka, Indiana. I had a great third grade teacher, Miss Patricia Swarm, who noticed that in classroom assignments, when you're supposed to sit down and read aloud, I would always read ahead in the book to see what was going to happen next. So she encouraged me to go to our school's library, and I still remember there's this large bookcase near the door into the library. It was just jammed full of these, I believe they were orange or yellowish orange covered books. And what they were the many volumes in Bob's Merrill Company of Indianapolis's Childhood of Famous Americans series. And these were biographies of notable Americans. They featured these black and white woodcut drawings throughout that really caught my attention. But I can still remember today details from those books about Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig. I was a big baseball fan, so I was drawn to those
Oh,
particular books. And
yeah.
now later on, I learned that a lot of some of the details in these books didn't really happen. Some of the dialogue was made up just to make a better story. But it got me fascinated with biography, and I've always been a big fan of that genre. And I think it followed me into my career starting out as a newspaper reporter, because you're dealing every day with people, getting them to tell you their story. And I think that influenced my choice to start writing biographies.
Before we get to the biographies you've written, I have to mention something. When you were talking about Bob's Merrill in the biographies, and then you mentioned, because I was going to mention him, Lou Gehrig, I wonder if we read that same biography, because that's my first memory of the first biography I ever read. And I remember, the just the haunting, incredibly moving story of him going up to bat, once he gets what came to be called Lou Gehrig's disease, and the courage of this man and the determination. I think I wanted to learn about people like that.
Yeah, I still remember. The one thing that struck me from my thing from that volume was that he and his mother like went fishing for eels in the New York River, and that detail stuck with me all this time, even many years later. So that shows, I think, what a good writer can do. Just these little items that stick with you forever.
That's right. I never realized, of course, when I was a kid that someday I would be a biographer, and that I would write a biography of Walter Brennan, who appeared in a film about Lou Gehrig with Gary Cooper,
Cooper,
and
right.
wrote about that film. That brought everything back to me from my childhood.
It just shows how the influence that a good teacher can have on a student, because I don't think I would be where I am today without the encouragement of Miss Warm in third grade.
I've just written a long essay about it for a book called Writers and Their Teachers. It's not my book, but I have a chapter in the book in which I talk about the teachers who really had an impact, and certainly the historians and writers who I got to know, even as an undergraduate, had an enormous impact.
And that continued later on. I mentioned the school library at Mary Phyllis Elementary, which had these books from Bob's Merrill. But later on, when I went to junior high and high school, our school libraries influenced my interest in World War II because they had stocked on their shelves a Time Life series that had different volumes on various aspects of the war from the Pacific to the European theater with great photographs. They were written by former war correspondents like Robert Sherrod, who I later wrote about, Keith Wheeler. And just seeing those books got me fascinated in the war, particularly in the Pacific theater.
So did you decide to do your first biography or did someone ask you to?
It grew out of my work for my master's degree in U.S. history at Indiana University, Indianapolis. For the past 30 years, I've been employed by the Indiana Historical Society here in Indianapolis. And I had started writing for its popular history magazine, Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History. And its editor, Kent Calder, encouraged me to pursue my education in history. So I went back and got my master's degree. And my master's thesis was on an Indiana historian and newspaper writer, Jacob Pyatt Dunn Jr. And I got done with the thesis. I thought I could really expand this into a full-scale biography. And I was lucky enough to have the Indiana Historical Society publish that. And I've been writing biography ever since.
Yes, and you have. I was going to ask you, what's with this love affair with Indiana?
Well, it's born and raised in Indiana, grew up in Mishawaka, worked for a couple of small newspaper dailies in the Hoosier State, went to Indiana University, worked at the Historical Society now for more than 30 plus years, so it comes naturally to me. So I've been drawn to people from Indiana who really made a difference, not only in our state, but also on the nation and the world as well.
But Ray, you know, I'm disappointed. You still haven't started that blog. I even gave you the title, Who's a Hoosier?
That's true. I should, because there's always these different tales and a new one comes up every year, it seems, on, you know, what a Hoosier is and what a Hoosier means.
Yeah.
There's a lot of entertaining tales.
Yeah.
From people like James Whitcomb Riley to anyone else.
That's right. Well, tell us the route by which you got to Richard Tregaskis and who Richard Tregaskis is.
Well, I've always been interested in war correspondence, and that grew out of my time at Indiana University in Bloomington. I majored in journalism there, and the journalism department was housed in what was called Ernie Pyle Hall. Ernie Pyle also went to Indiana University, and he's probably the best-known correspondent of World War II, the best-known columnist and writer of the experience of the infantry on the front lines. And there was a lounge area on the second floor of the Ernie Pyle Hall. And there was these cases full of memorabilia from his life, including a shovel, typewriter, his Pulitzer Prize citation. So that really got me interested in the people who went out and reported on the war. And when I started here at the Indiana Historical Society, I was able to start what was called a youth biography series. And these are books geared toward middle and high school students about people from Indiana's past. And I was lucky enough to write a volume on Ernie Pyle and his life. And that decided to continue that and picked another correspondent to write about, Robert Sherrod, who wrote for Time and Life magazine during World War II, was at the crucial Battle of Tarawa, followed the Marines in the Central Pacific. That was published by Indiana University Press. And so I had two under my belt, and I thought, well, I might as well write what I'm calling my war correspondent trilogy. And I looked at various people who wrote about the war, and one that drew my attention was Richard Tregaskis. I had read his best-selling book in the classic of World War II, reporting Guadalcanal Diary when I was in high school. So he immediately sprung to mind. And I was really impressed about the broad scope of his experiences during the war. He started out reporting from the Pacific Theater, spending time on Navy ships with ground troops, also flying mission with the Air Corps. And from there, he went to the European Theater, reporting on the invasions of Sicily and Italy. And while in Italy, was nearly killed by a German shell. And as even Pyle noted, if he had had his wound, he would have gone home and rested on his laurels forever. But he didn't do that. You know, he went back to the fighting, went back to Europe, was there after the breakout from Normandy and the street fighting in Aachen, Germany, went back to the United States. And, you know, I would have stayed there. But he was convinced by the editor of the Saturday Evening Post to follow a B-29 crew flying from the United States for and then going to the Pacific to a base on Guam, and from there flying with them on missions bombing cities in Japan. And he was there when the war ended. So just the scope of his travels, his experiences at some crucial turning points in the war. He was on the task force on a ship watching as the Doolittle Raiders took off from the USS Hornet to bomb Tokyo. Transferred to the Hornet, was there for the crucial Battle of Midway, and really made a name for himself as a young reporter, you know, in his mid-20s with the Marines during those first crucial weeks on Guadalcanal, trying to wrest that island from control of the Japanese. And then wrote a book about it, and it became a bestseller.
It is an amazing life and an amazing story. I've written about war correspondent too, Martha Gellhorn.
Martha Gellhorn, yes. Very good book.
Thank you. You probably know more about war correspondents than I do, but here's a guy who was a diabetic.
Indeed.
And also went back into action with a hole in his head.
It was with a metal plate in his head. And he kept his sense of humor about it. He joked with his doctors, asking them, you know, if it was bulletproof, but unfortunately it was not.
Yeah. I mean, you know, other writers like William Faulkner, he lied about going to war and having a metal plate in his head. Mm-hmm. But here's somebody who actually had one.
Yeah, I think he owed, he always felt an obligation to the men doing the actual fighting, doing, you know, and their experiences in combat. And although, you know, he didn't really want to go, he thought he had to. And so he went.
How was he able to disguise? I mean, you do explain this in the book, but I want you to talk about it. How was he able to disguise the fact that he was a diabetic?
Well, he kept it at first secret from his employers. He was a reporter for the International News Service, and this is a news agency. At the time, it was kind of third rank. You had the Associated Press, which was the leading news bureau for newspapers across the country. You had a second one, United Press, and then bringing up the rear was the International News Service, which didn't have the manpower that the two other news agencies did. But it had a lot of go-getters when it came to reporters like Bob Considine and Tregaskis himself. So he learned about his illness, which was a family illness, diabetes, when he was working in the New York office of the INS and just been turned down for service in the war because of bad eyesight. He was also very tall. He was more than 6'5" in height, so he did not fall within the height requirements. And really, you know, wanted to do something for the war effort. And he was lucky enough to be sent overseas by his employers, but always had to be carefully to watch his diet. Insulin had been developed by that time, but he did not depend on that during his service in World War II. Later he did, he took insulin shots, but he tried to control his diet. And he packed with them a handbook. It was called Diabetic Manual for the Doctor and Patient, that was written about the disease by Dr. Elliot P. Joslin, who was an early pioneer in the field. And he'd even kind of faked an autograph that said, "To my friend Richard Tergaskis, best wishes from Dr. Elliot P. Joslin." And if anyone ever came across his book and saw the book in his backpack, he could demonstrate that, you know, the doctor was a friend, and he carried the book only for sentimental reasons. And although I was never able to track down the precise time that people knew he had diabetes, it was printed in a column that Ernie Pyle wrote about Tergaskis after his wounding in Italy, because, of course, when he was wounded, Tergaskis had to tell the doctors about his condition, so they knew about it. And so Ernie Pyle, when he wrote his column, mentioned it. So I think that was really the first wide-scale distribution of the fact that he had this illness and was dealing with it while he was doing his wartime service.
Since you've written about Pyle too, I mean, what's the difference between these correspondents, would you say?
I think it's the they share a lot of things in common, both Pyle, Tergaskis, and Robert Schrod, who I wrote about. And there was a key fact about them, I think people should know, that, as Schrod said, they didn't want to be seen as what he called communique commandos. That is, people, reporters who were willing to stay behind the lines back at headquarters and depend on the canned handouts and news releases from PROs, what were known as public relations officers, who were trying to tout the accomplishments of their generals and get their name in the paper. People like Pyle and Tergaskis wanted to know what was happening, wanted to see for themselves what was going on with the men on the front lines. And one also difference between Pyle and Tergaskis, of course, was that Pyle was a columnist. He could put, I think, more of his personal self into what he wrote. But Tergaskis was a reporter, reporting on action and trying to, get more newsy coverage of what was going on, the progress of the war. But they all wanted to be there, experience what the men were experiencing on the front lines, eating what they ate, sleeping how they slept, exposed to enemy fire, particularly on Guadalcanal with Tergaskis. It was very desperate, sometimes hand-to-hand fighting that occurred on the island between the Marines and the Japanese, and Tergaskis was there to see it all.
This had to have been of enormous value to the American public to, to, in a sense, see, as they, Gellhorn did this in some of her mm-hmm. dispatches, to have a writer who was a kind of window on this world, without editorializing very much, if at all, and just really sort of laying it out what it was like for the frontline soldiers.
Exactly. And people back on the home front, there was not the instantaneous communication that we have today. They might have been able to get news bulletins over radio broadcasts, for example, but they really depended upon newspaper reporters to learn about the day-to-day activity in the war and what was happening with their loved ones overseas. And in doing my research on Tergaskis, thankfully, I didn't have to depend on old microfilm film reels like I used to. But thanks to online services like newspapers.com, I could go back and see the broad scope of his reporting. And it appeared in newspapers across the United States, from small towns to big cities. And people were dependent on reporters like Tergaskis to get their war news and see what was going on.
You started to talk about it. I wanted to ask you about your sources. Obviously, he wrote a lot and published a lot, so there's all that for a biographer to rely on. But what else is there?
Well, I was lucky enough to do some travels in archives across the United States. There are two main repositories of his papers. One at the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University. And then there's a second repository. It's the American Heritage Center at the University of Wyoming. And if you've never seen a photo of the Heritage Center, you should look it up, because it's a very unusual looking building there in Laramie, Wyoming. And it's very impressive when you drive up to the parking lot to go inside to do research. So you have, you know, Trace Tregaskis's notebooks, his diaries. He also, I found at the American Heritage Center, he had started a memoir of his time reporting on war. And it was called The Bravest Men. And he had finished it all the way up in pretty good order until the time he was going to Guadalcanal with the Marines. And after that, there's just handwritten kind of sketchy details. He was outlining the chapters to come after that. But that was a great help to me in talking about his early time during the war when he was traveling from the United States to Hawaii to a naval headquarters there, going out on those first task forces, the Doolittle mission, which was top secret. Of course, his dispatches about that did not even appear in newspapers until a year after it had happened. And then the Battle of Midway, and then leading up and going with the Marines to Guadalcanal.
I haven't been to that Heritage Center in Wyoming, but it sounds fabulous. As I understand it, they have a lot of archives, particularly of journalists.
They do. I was impressed by the wide range of their collection there. And I kind of always wondered, you know, how did his papers end up there? I can understand why some of them are in Boston. You know, he was a Harvard University graduate. And so it's logical that some of his work ended up in Boston. But Gottlieb also has a wide range of journalist papers as well. David Halberstam's papers are there, and other correspondents as well. But it's just a great place to do research, the American Heritage Center. And they were quite helpful, not only with his papers, but in helping me obtain photographs. That a lot of the photographs in the book are from that repository.
Well, you'll have to email me who to talk to if you've got a contact there, because
I do.
There was a journalist who interviewed Faulkner, the very famous, infamous interview, really, in which Faulkner was clearly drinking, and made an outrageous statement about if it came to another civil war, he would side with Mississippi, even if it meant shooting, as he said, Negroes in the streets. He quickly recanted. He said, "Oh, I didn't, you know, I didn't say or I didn't mean that," and so on. But it's been quoted many, many times. And the journalist published two versions of this interview, one in the Sunday Times and one in the Reporter. And they're slightly different versions. And so, of course, as a biographer, what I want to know is, because he said he took verbatim notes, where are those notes?
Yeah.
I want to see those notes. Mm-hmm. So I tried to contact the Heritage Center of Wyoming, but I couldn't. There was a finding aid for this journalist's papers, but I couldn't really tell from that. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to actually go there and look through his stuff to see if those verbatim notes are there, because it might settle something if I could see, you know, what.
Right.
Although he was reporting what Faulkner said verbatim, so maybe not. But I'm, you know, it's one of the things about biography is you really have to try to track back to, you know, the origins of things, how things get disseminated sometimes in other biographies as well. And you find, well, it's not quite accurate, or it's not exactly the case.
That was a particular problem with my work on Tregaskis as well, because every time you come across someone writing about him, there's a different figure for just how tall he was.
Uh-huh.
You know, some people say, oh, he was, you know, this tall correspondent, he's 6'6". So, further, someone else says 6'7", and he seems to grow after his death. You know, he's 6'9" sometimes. But what I had to do was, I went back and lucky, you know, the archives have his official documents from the issued accrediting him as a war correspondent from the War Department, and they have him as like 6'5". So at least I can say he was, you know, at least 6'5" or taller.
Yeah. So. Now you do deal with his personal life as well. You know, this is a driven man, and like a lot of writers, it's hard to be married to somebody like that.
He had this wanderlust spirit at times. I think that was well known after the war. He couldn't stay in one place for any amount of time. He got back from the war, tried to be a screenwriter, writing for motion pictures, but got this, I think, once in a lifetime assignment from True Magazine to travel around the world and write about like what was going on in these far-flung locales. And he pitched it as, you know, trying to find the perfect place where to live. And so you go to these various exotic locations all across the Pacific and in Europe as well, and write about his experiences. Of course, that meant he was away from home for months at a time. And his wife, of course, naturally felt abandoned. And he remarried after his first divorce and really only found happiness with his third wife, Moana, who he met while he was living in Hawaii, where he finally settled down and finally found the right location to live. And Moana accompanied him on a lot of his trips to Vietnam. He was drawn to that conflict early on and kept going back to report on America's involvement in that war.
He wrote fiction too. Tell us why he wanted to write fiction.
He did write some fiction. Based on, I think a lot of it was based on his own travels overseas. I know that in one book that he based his character really on his own self as a correspondent and his experiences with that, but never really found success with that, and always went back to nonfiction and war reporting, which really was his forte, I think.
Yeah,
he always dreamed of bigger things. You know, he's a freelance writer, you know, trying to make a living with that. But I think people almost pigeonholed him because of his wartime service.
Sure. And
his most successful books were written in that diary format that first won him fame with Guadalcanal Diary. His second book, Invasion Diary, was also in that format. And he wrote a book about the development of the X-15 rocket plane, X-15 Diary. And then when he went to Vietnam, he also wrote a book about his time there as Vietnam Diary. So that diary format really served him well, I think. And for his particular strength was firsthand reporting, you know, yes, what he saw. And he wasn't someone you turned to for the big strategic picture of the war in World War II. But no, he just had a knack for finding fascinating individuals to attach to for various missions during the war, from Colonel Edson on Guadalcanal to this mad British commando, Jack Churchill, in Sicily. And there's some dramatic writing that he did, Invasion Diary, about his time with this British commando in this race to get to Messina before Patton's troops did on the island of Sicily, and a very dangerous drive along mountain roads trying to get into the city before U.S. troops did.
Yes, yeah. By the time he gets to Vietnam, of course, it's a very different world and a very different kind of war. And for me, what epitomizes the differences is what happens with his sort of relationship with David Halberstam. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think the uncharitable view that he had of Halberstam and some of the other young reporters who were based in Vietnam, who were starting to question the official optimistic view of our involvement in the war in South Vietnam and the administration officials there, I think was prompted in part by his experiences in combat during World War II. And, you know, he really had an unflinching belief to the end of his life in the need for the United States to respond forcefully to communist aggression, especially in Vietnam. And he also, his continued admiration for the skill and bravery of U.S. troops in the field. And, you know, the younger reporters were starting to question, you know, weren't taking at face value what his government was telling them. And I think Tregaskis believed that criticizing the war could be seen as belittling the courage of the troops. But Halberstam, you know, saw that his pointing out errors in how the war was being run was really helping the troops in the field. And Halberstam tells this story about he was a big fan of Tregaskis and had read his books about World War II and was eager to show him what was going on in Vietnam, and took him out in the field one day and introduced him to a lot of his own sources. And they were coming back from that excursion out into the field. And Halberstam says that Tregaskis told him, you know, if I was doing what you were doing, I'd be ashamed of myself, which really crushed Halberstam. But and I think it's just that clash of generations. And Tregaskis saw this as really the first shot in World War III. You know, this communist aggression from China was threatening to sweep in and take over these smaller countries. And he'd been concerned about, you know, the rise of communism and our failure and countering its growth through a vigorous propaganda effort, and something he tried but failed to get editors to pay attention to. And he sent out essays about it to a variety of news services and complained that they wouldn't publish them without because his work was too controversial.
Yeah, I think Tregaskis' mindset, his temper, was obviously shaped by World War II. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading about that in your book, I was thinking too about my relatives, my father's family in particular, who were just so upset about Vietnam protests. And I think they saw everything through their own experience of the war, and the war for them was World War II.
Indeed.
And they, you know, they had fully absorbed the story of appeasement, of what happens when you give in to evil, whether it's fascism or communism. And I think that, you know, Tregaskis was speaking for himself, obviously, mm-hmm. but in a way for a whole generation, that kind of clash that was going on in different attitudes toward war.
Exactly. And I think Tregaskis realized, you know, that war was exciting, but there was another aspect of it that he liked, and that was that because you at the front and you didn't expect to live very long, so you tended to be free of the, you know, the petty selfishness that governs people in time of absolute safety and assumed longevity. And at he said this to someone, at the front, if someone wants your shirt, you'll give it to him. Men are unselfish and self-sacrificing as never elsewhere. While they're trying to kill people on the other side, they'll die for people on their own side. And that was an intriguing aspect about his wartime experiences that he always remembered.
Yeah, and I think it's a universal feeling. Yeah. You know, people think about war correspondents and they think usually of men, though there were female war correspondents. Right. Like Gellhorn, who had the same feeling that Tregaskis had, mm-hmm. who felt she was living a purer kind of life while she was covering the war, and a sense of human solidarity that was very hard for her to replicate in peacetime.
Of course, these women correspondents like Gellhorn, Ruth Cowan, Lee Miller, and many others who were trying to cover the war faced a lot more difficulties than these male correspondents did. They're just facing obstinate officers at the front who don't think that, you know, women should be there. And yeah. I love the part in your book about Gellhorn where she hides in the bathroom to go across across for a D-Day operation on the hospital ship. And it shows you the links a lot of these reporters went to, the female reporters, to get their story.
Hemingway was so upset because he was stuck in a boat. You know, he wasn't on the beach, the Normandy beach. And the fact that she had made it farther than he did, he just never forgot that, never forgave her for that.
Yeah, that's talk about a scoop. That's a scoop.
That's a scoop. Yeah, that's a scoop. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you about Tregaskis. It's a wonderfully well-written book.
Thank you.
I would call it riveting.
And I have to say that a small part of thanks should go to you, because the book might not have happened without your help. While I was writing it, I had some interest from an agent, Philip Turner, who you had worked with, and I got your opinion about him, and you got a good reference from you. And so I've worked with Philip on the book, and he managed to get it published by the University of New Mexico Press. So it might never have been happened. It might never have happened without your help, Carl.
So now you know what's going to happen, Ray. What? I'm going to get all these queries. I'm a star maker.
You're a star maker. That's right. Just like Hollywood.
Yeah, just like Hollywood. That's right. Is there anything else I should have asked you that you'd like to talk about?
I think you've covered everything.
That's good.
Yeah. Now I can take this off my bucket list as a biographer. I've appeared on A Life in Biography.
That's right. Yes. Yes. You're memorialized. Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Ray.
I appreciate it, Carl.
We'll do this again with your next biography.
I'm working on it. This one's about one of the young correspondents we were talking about from Vietnam, Malcolm Brown, who was the AP bureau chief in Saigon. And it really focuses on how he came to capture one of the enduring images from the Vietnam War, the Buddhist monk who immolated himself on a Saigon street to protest the policies of the Diem government. And I think it's really one of the three photos that, if you think of Vietnam, you think of that photo. You think of the photo of the little girl who was running down the street naked after a napalm attack. And then during the Tet Offensive, the photo of the Saigon police officer shooting a suspected VC guerrilla in the head. And all these images spring to mind when you think of Vietnam. So I'm looking about his time early on in the early 1960s during the start of America's involvement in the war, and his reporting from Saigon during that time period and the capture.
Yeah. That sounds fascinating. Another good book.
I hope so.
Okay, Ray, we're going to quit while we're ahead.
Great. Thanks, Carl.
Sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.